the nuclear arms race. Are we talking about history or are we talking about the future? Because it could be both right now. The way things are going right now, especially between the United States, Russia, and China, all kinds of issues are on the table with those with the nuclear arms. It should be, without any question, not even on the table. The fact that in this modern era, with all the technological capabilities and the nuclear potential that are out there, that we're even talking about this today, should be a big alarm to everyone, and especially in light of Russia's recent testing of two separate arms, new nuclear, one missile and one submersible. This should have everybody talking about getting rid of them, not expanding them. But unfortunately, human nature being what it is, we usually want to escalate and one-up somebody. We're going to see how that's going to work out. And to try and make some sense out of all this nonsense and nuttiness, we have international relations theorist expertise with John Mearsheimer, professor of political science at the University of Chicago and big-time friend of the show. John, welcome back as always.
As always, I'm glad to be back, Danny.
Well, listen, I mean, it's not like there's anything important to talk about today, so we're going to have to really scratch. I mean, it's just, you know, the potential annihilation of mankind. But, I mean, other than that, it's just kind of, you know, business as usual. So, let's just kind of start off on the look at the near-term issue here, which is on the table, is the fact that Russia has just fired this new Burevestnik nuclear Tomahawk type missile that can allegedly fly all over the world and have almost unlimited range with its nuclear propulsion system, which is a new, and then this underwater Poseidon, which could basically wipe out entire sections of any coastline like New York City or so. What do you make of these two developments?
I don't think they matter very much at all. What the Russia has hundreds of nuclear weapons, thousands of nuclear weapons that can hit the United States. What difference do these weapons make? I just don't understand.
And well, I guess what the, at least my concern is that by accelerating this discussion and about bringing in new weapon categories, et cetera, is that we have the risk that, okay, what the United States may say, all right, well, you've done that. Now we're going to do it. We're going to do some more, and we're going to develop some new capabilities because both of these two weapon systems, well, especially the Burevestnik and the Oreshnik before that, were because of anti-ballistic missile treaty we got out of and the intermediate nuclear treaty that we got out of. So arms limitation treaties that we got rid of now seem to be expanding it, and that seems to be my concern. How do you feel about that?
Look, the point is you have a situation where both Russia and the United States have thousands of nuclear weapons. By my count, the Russians have about 4,300, and we have about 3,700. And each side, no matter who strikes first, can wipe out the other side, destroy the other side's society, make us disappear from the planet. What advantage do you gain by developing more of these weapons? I want you to tell me what is the story as to how you win the war. Are these war-winning weapons? They're not war-winning weapons. There are no war-winning weapons when it comes to a massive nuclear exchange. Everybody gets exterminated, period. So we're going to have all these discussions about these new weapons, and everybody's going to pretend that they really matter, and the Russians may have an advantage, and we have to check that advantage, and so forth and so on. This is all just idle chatter. The fact is we both have an assured destruction capability. We live in a mad world, mutual assured destruction, and we're not at a point or anywhere near a point where one side can gain an advantage over the other side. So it just doesn't matter.
And what about in terms of, we seem to be in a situation, I won't say a spiral, but we're in an escalating situation to where people are much more comfortable about talking about nuclear escalation and seem to have a lot less fear about the consequences of an engagement in this area here. And so these kinds of things just add to that, because as you're going to see here in a minute, we're going to have some comments from both President Trump and Senator Tom Cotton who seem to be talking like, I don't know, like they're just talking about whatever happened to the scores of the baseball game last night or something. There's not a lot of alarm that goes with it. And that by itself is concerning to me.
Yeah, that's somewhat concerning. There's no question about that. But the fact is that when anybody gets serious about thinking about using nuclear weapons, you almost immediately recognize that you can't gain an advantage with some sort of splendid first strike. Again, there's no way that these new Russian weapons give them a military advantage over us. It's just not possible at this point in time, because you have a situation where both sides have massive arsenals, and a splendid first strike is impossible. You can't take out the other side's nuclear arsenal. So if you strike first with nuclear weapons, the other side will be able to retaliate, and both sides will end up destroying each other. So I just don't think that this matters very much.
And so how would you characterize, I guess, the nuclear clock that some, you know, talk about, how close it is to midnight, if it's far, if it's closer, that through either arrogance, stupidity, miscalculation, and mistake, that we could actually get to that? And is there anything we can do to move that back and make it less likely?
Well, I do think that you have to worry about a possible nuclear war. I'm not arguing against that. There's no question you could have inadvertent nuclear escalation. You could have significant miscalculation of one sort or another, where you could even have a limited use of nuclear weapons. You and I have talked about the possibility that the Russians could use nuclear weapons in Ukraine because Ukraine doesn't have the capability to retaliate, and we certainly wouldn't retaliate on Ukraine's behalf. So these are scenarios that you want to avoid, and I could point to other ones as well. The only point I'm making to you is these new weapons do not make any difference in terms of the strategic nuclear balance between the United States and Russia. We live in a mad world. Neither side at this point in time is anywhere near the point where they can gain an advantage over the other. That's all I'm saying. I'm not saying that the threat of nuclear war has been taken off the table, because as long as there are nuclear weapons on the planet, even just one nuclear weapon, there is a danger that it will be used. And I do think we have to go to great lengths to make sure that doesn't happen. I fully understand that. Again, you remember when we talked about the fact that the Ukrainians, basically, who without permission, attacked one leg of the nuclear triad of Russia. This was foolish in the extreme, sending ground forces, Ukrainian ground forces, backed by the United States and the European allies into Mother Russia, I think was extremely foolish. You know, we don't want to do foolish things. We don't want to precipitate some form of nuclear war. But again, I think that's a different issue.
Right. No, totally get that, that because of the thousands that are out there, a different category of them doesn't change the fact of them in any capacity, whether any of the legs of the triad that exists. So in terms of adding to it, it hasn't actually changed it, because you can't defend with the missile anyway. So I guess in that regard, I certainly agree with that. I guess my concern is that it could lead us to be more stupidity and to take greater risk. Here is what President Trump said earlier today on this topic.
Do you worry that we're entering a more risky environment when it comes to nuclear issues?
No, I don't think so. I think we have it pretty well locked up. But we have more than anybody. But I see them testing. I say, well, if they're going to test, I guess we have to test. I'd like to see a denuclearization, because we have so many, and Russia has some. Russia's second and China's third, and China will catch up within 4 or 5 years. I think de-escalation would be they would call it denuclearization, would be a tremendous thing. And it's something we are actually talking to Russia about, that, and China would be added to that if we do something.
So what do you make of that? Because first, like, yeah, no, we got that locked up. We're good to go. But hey, it would be great to denuclearize. What do you take away from his comments about what he thinks about nuclear war?
Make 2 points. First of all, I think it's quite remarkable that this comes out of nowhere right before he meets with President Xi in South Korea. It's really quite remarkable how Trump just sort of throws these things out there all of a sudden. I'm always amazed at that. Second point I would make is that he has two major misstatements in his pronouncement. It's quite remarkable that he says things that are simply not true. First of all, we do not have more nuclear weapons than the Russians do. The Russians have the most number of nuclear weapons in the world. This is a well-established fact. So what he said was false. Then he said that the Russians and the Chinese, these other states, are testing nuclear weapons. And that's why we now have to test nuclear weapons. That's simply not true. They're not testing nuclear weapons. The Russians haven't tested a nuclear weapon since 1990. And the Chinese have not tested a nuclear weapon since 1996. And by the way, we have not tested a nuclear weapon since 1992. What the Russians are testing, which is obviously what he's thinking about, are they're testing a new cruise missile and a new sea-based drone, both of which have nuclear propulsion systems. We're not talking about testing a nuclear warhead. We're talking about a nuclear propulsion system, which is a fundamentally different thing. So what Trump is saying is that we're going to start to test nuclear weapons because others are testing nuclear weapons, but they're not testing nuclear weapons. What's going on here? Is this the way a great power like the United States is supposed to conduct business? I mean, I just find this all quite remarkable. Get your facts straight. And maybe
not important in this case.
Straight, we can come up with some sort of coherent policy.
But yet, and one wonders if he may have been mischaracterizing what happened there. But one would imagine, one would hope that anybody he would give an order to, the Department of Defense or Department of Energy, wherever those that actually command authority lies, to say, hey, test. They would say, you mean like test some kind of a platform, right? Not an actual missile, because that would, as you said, I don't think anybody's done it since 96 anywhere in the world. I don't think North Korea, I guess. Yeah. But other than that, there hadn't been any. And I don't think that we would need to do that. Hopefully he's talking about the other one. But then again, even if he's talking about that, then the question is, do we have some kind of new propulsion system that we would need to test the missile and the rocket that goes with it, et cetera?
Well, you can test the nuclear propulsion system. There's no problem there. That doesn't violate, you know, any treaty.
Right. But the point being is it, do we have, because the Russians, these were allegedly anyway, new categories that they had to actually field test here. We don't have any new categories. So you would just be running something up in the air, which we do periodically anyway. That's actually not uncommon. Is there anything new that we could test that we haven't done before, to your knowledge?
I have no idea, really. I mean, the Russians are obviously going down this road. We're not going down the road, at least in a major way. But it's largely irrelevant to the question of nuclear testing, which is what he's now talking about doing. I mean, it's kind of bizarre. He's talking about de-escalating the nuclear arms race. He gives you the impression he'd like to get rid of nuclear weapons like President Reagan used to talk about. But if anything, this is just going to ramp up the arms race, because right, we're the ones who are initiating nuclear testing now when no one has tested since 1996. And by the way, virtually all the scientists I know who study this issue say there's no need to test, that the that our nuclear arsenal is in fine shape. We don't need tests to see if it really is reliable. It is reliable. So again, the more you think about what's going on here, the more you just sort of scratch your head and say, is this the way a great power like the United States is supposed to behave?
And, you know, when Trump first came into office, he had mentioned some things about wanting to see a denuclearized world, bringing up some of the language of that Reagan had said. And then it's like that was a speech one day and then just kind of went away and didn't talk about it again. And we had a Russian ambassador, Polyansky, who's the deputy UN ambassador, just last week. And we were asking about this issue because Russia has been saying openly, and we asked him about it, that they would like to see go back to nuclear arms limitation treaties. We got out of some. The last one on the table still on the last legs is this New START, which is going to expire in February. And they said that they would love to talk about, first of all, just getting a one-year moratorium on that to give the technical teams a chance to start talking, maybe bring in China, et cetera. But he said that the United States is not willing to do it. Trump, in that soundbite right there, said, we are talking to Russia. What do you make of that?
Well, he says that he is interested in the Russian proposal. Trump, that is, says he's interested. Whether we agree to extend the START agreement again remains to be seen. It expires at the beginning of next year, so they'll have to make a decision one way or the other. But, you know, in a very important way, Danny, here, the key player is China. You want to remember that virtually all these arms control agreements that we have in place today or that have been recently put in the trash basket by us, I would note, were arms control agreements that are vestiges of the Cold War and the U.S.-Soviet competition. And the fact is, we now live in a multipolar world, not a bipolar world. And in that multipolar world is this country called China, which is actually more powerful relative to the United States than Russia is. It's China that's the peer competitor. All of that tells you that if you're going to have arms control moving forward, you're going to have to bring the Chinese into the equation. And that's going to be very tricky to do. And I would note to you, you know, I was saying that I think that we have about 3,700 warheads, and I think the Russians have about 4,300. The Chinese have probably about 600 warheads, and that just tells you that they're going to build up their arsenal, right? You're going to see a significant increase in the size of the Chinese nuclear arsenal.
And let me ask you a question, because that almost puzzles me. For the reason that you've mentioned a minute ago, once you get beyond a certain number, it's superfluous with both of us. So why is China worried about building up the number when they already, even with 600, have more than enough to have, you know, second strike capability, et cetera?
I would just note to you that during the Cold War, we had, and I'm choosing my words carefully here, we had massive overkill, and the Soviets had massive overkill. Right. And nevertheless, we both continued to build up the size of our arsenals, because what we were looking to do is to find some sort of magic way to defeat the other side. And eventually, everybody came to recognize that that was not possible, that right. You know, you could not achieve a splendid first strike. And I believe that one of the reasons that we agreed to the original SALT agreement in 1972 and a number of subsequent arms control agreements involving strategic nuclear weapons is because we thought it was not very smart to arms race anymore in the strategic nuclear realm. So we agreed to these arms control agreements, and then we took the resources that we spent in that realm and spent it in other realms. So it's very important to understand that when you get an arms control agreement, whether it's SALT, START, or what have you, it slow down the arms race in any meaningful way. What it does is it just moves the arms race from one realm to the other realm. And that's what you saw in the Cold War. But I think the Chinese will not be happy until they have a nuclear arsenal that's roughly the size of the American and the Russian arsenals. But to your point, I'm not sure that's necessary. All you need is a handful of nuclear weapons that can get through, and you've got an assured destruction capability. And by the way, you know, there's all this talk about Golden Dome in the United States. We're going to build this missile defense system that's going to be able to knock down all of the incoming Russian or Chinese warheads. This is delusional, right? Because when the other side has thousands of nuclear warheads, only a small percentage has to get through to turn your country into a smoking, radiating ruin. And there's no way Golden Dome is going to knock down 100% of the incoming missiles. So it's just throwing money down a rat hole. And if I'm the Russians or the Chinese, I want to do everything I can to encourage the money, the United States, to build Golden Dome. Because all that money they spend on Golden Dome will be money that they can't spend on other systems that might be really meaningful from my point of view, my meaning being a Chinese or a Russian point of view.
You know, I want to go back to something you said a second ago about definitions matter. Using the right terminology matters. And are we thinking in the right way? You mentioned a couple of it that President Trump had said in that one soundbite. Well, there's another phrase that's going to be used here by Senator Tom Cotton on this same topic. And he's going to use this term here that we cannot unilaterally disarm, and see if you can put this in the right context. Watch this.
I think President Trump is once again reflecting sentiment that President Reagan had in the 1980s. They both regretted the necessity of nuclear weapons. They dreamed of a world in which we might not have nuclear weapons. But as long as adversaries like communist Russia back in the day, and today Russia and communist China, have nuclear weapons and they're rapidly expanding their arsenal and they're testing their weapons, the United States can't afford to unilaterally disarm. That we have to make sure that our nuclear arsenal is second to none, that it won't be overmatched by the combined forces of Russia and China, that our aging weapons are still usable, and that our new weapons are designed and made properly. So I agree with what President Trump has announced. It's only sensible that in a world when Russia and China are threatening the United States with a rapidly growing and novel nuclear arsenal, that we have to take steps to defend our way of life, because that's what our nuclear arsenal does. It truly defends our way of life.
Well, let's just look at the last part of that. First of all, is China and Russia threatening America's way of life?
No. No, in fact, the last time I looked, the only one of those three countries that attacked the nuclear arsenal of the other country was the United States operating through the Ukrainians. The Ukrainians attacked the Russian nuclear triad, their strategic triad, as we talked about before. And the Ukrainians are joined at the hip with the United States and the British. So if anybody is a threat to one of those powers, it's the United States that's a threat to Russia. I think what Tom Cotton is trying to do here is say that the only reason we have a nuclear arsenal is because of the Russians and the Chinese. We're the good guys, they're the bad guys. There'd be no nuclear weapons on the planet if it weren't for all these bad guys that we good guys have to deal with. This is the standard American story that you hear all the time. This is nonsense. The United States has nuclear weapons. Russia has nuclear weapons. Israel has nuclear weapons. India has nuclear weapons. And none of those countries are interested in giving them up because they are the ultimate deterrent. You're not going to get rid of nuclear weapons because in a dangerous world, you want the ultimate deterrent if you can have your hands on it. That's why we spend so much time dealing with nuclear proliferation, because there are lots of countries around the world which would like to have a nuclear arsenal, not because they're evil, but because they understand that a nuclear arsenal is the ultimate deterrent. As you and I have talked about before, if you're in Iran and you, Danny, are the national security advisor in Iran, you're going to tell the leadership to get nuclear weapons, in large part because they are the ultimate deterrent. And the United States and the Israelis will not fool around with you if you have a nuclear arsenal. Everybody figures this out. It's not a world of good guys and bad guys. States are usually rational. And if you're rational, you understand that having the ultimate deterrent is a good thing. And of course, this is why you're never going to get rid of nuclear weapons. I think President Reagan was a very idealistic person in this regard. He was something of a dreamer. And I don't want to be too critical of him, because I think his basic instincts in a certain way were noble. But on the other hand, they were just unrealistic. The United States is not going to get rid of its nuclear weapons. Let me just point this out to you, Danny. When the Cold War ended and then the Soviet Union collapses in December 1991, we were the most powerful state in the history of the world. We were Godzilla, right? You would think in a world where we had the most powerful conventional forces in the world, think about this. After 1991, we have the most powerful conventional forces in the world, that we then would have taken steps to eliminate nuclear weapons. Because, again, we have such powerful conventional forces. But we did no such thing. We had no interest in getting rid of our nuclear weapons, right? And again, it's because nuclear weapons are the ultimate deterrent.
And I want to kind of move on a little bit forward from that. I want to stick with this issue of the Russia-Ukraine war, because it seems to keep on bleeding into what we're talking about here. And in his comments today, President Trump also addressed how he's trying to bring that war to an end. And one of the things he's now trying to do, his current du jour plan, is to use economic sanctions to bring Russia to the table finally. And he's doing that with oil. And here's how he puts it.
We're both going to work together to see if we can get something done. We agree the sides are, you know, locked in and fighting. And sometimes you have to let them fight, I guess. Crazy. But he's going to help us, and we're going to work together on Ukraine. There's not a lot more we can do. He's been buying oil from Russia for a long time. It takes care of a big part of China. And, you know, I can say India's been very good on that front. But we didn't really discuss the oil. We discussed working together to see if we could get that war finished.
I mean, one of the things that really jumped out to me was the last part of that, to where he said, and we're going to talk about the China portion of this in a minute, but he said this meeting with Xi Jinping was a 12 out of 10. And then he says, of course, we didn't talk about Taiwan, and apparently we didn't talk about the oil issue, which is his point to try to bring Russia to its knees. But yet no talk to you or China, which is one of the biggest use derivatives of oil. And he just says India is fine. But from what I've seen, and I looked just before we came on the air here, India has not made any declaration to stop buying Russian oil. How do you see that issue playing out?
Well, look, just to elevate to 60,000 feet, Trump said he was going to shut down the Ukraine war before he even moved in the White House. And then he said after he moved in the White House, he would shut it down immediately. He has failed. This is going nowhere, right? The idea that he's going to negotiate some sort of settlement with the Russians, that train has left the station, right? How much more evidence do we need of that? Okay, so let's talk about what we can do to force the Russians to accept the deal. There's two ways of thinking about this. One is what happens on the battlefield. And two is to think about a punishment campaign. There's two ways you wage war in the modern era. One is you wage war on the battlefield. And number two, you punish the civilian population. You hit the home front. Now, what's happening in Ukraine, as you well know, is that the Russians are on the march. The Ukrainians are really in desperate straits. We won't go into the details here, but it's quite clear for anybody who follows this war closely that the Ukrainians are in deep trouble, and they can barely defend themselves, much less launch offensives. So if the battlefield situation is going badly, what you do is you go to a punishment campaign, and that's what the Ukrainians and the Americans are doing. The drones that the Ukrainians are launching deep into Russia are part of a punishment campaign. These drones, these drone attacks are not going to influence events on the battlefield. They can't change the situation on the battlefield. So they're punishing Russia by hitting its energy facilities. The tariffs fit into that broad picture. The tariffs are part of a punishment campaign. We're going to damage the Russian economy the same way the drone attacks on oil facilities or energy facilities in Russia are going to hurt their economy. The drone attacks are a pinprick, and sanctions are not going to work. We've tried sanctions time after time.
What are the 19 rounds, to be specific?
Yeah. I mean, we finally found the magic formula, Danny, right? Oh, what about those Tomahawk missiles? Let's give them 10 Tomahawk missiles. That'll this one around. Right. I think 10 Tomahawk missiles, Danny, and these new economic sanctions, and we're home free. I want to make one final point. We have a rich history of how successful or not or unsuccessful punishment campaigns have been. And it is unequivocally clear that punishment campaigns fail almost every time. And this punishment campaign is not really a significant punishment campaign. Mm. If you want to talk about a significant punishment campaign, look at what we did to North Korea between 1950 and 1953.
Yeah.
Look at what we did in Southeast Asia between 1964 and 1973. Look at what we did to Japan and Germany in World War II. And those punishment campaigns did not work.
And look at the one here, Gary, showing up on the screen. The Russian one against Ukraine. That was another 705 missiles and drones last night. And yet even that hasn't brought Ukraine to its knees. And that's much, much higher than anything even contemplated in the other direction.
Exactly. Wars are won on the battlefield in almost all cases. This one is going to be settled on the battlefield. The punishment campaign that we're engaged in is not going to work. So Trump is just tilting at windmills here. And he is brilliant at that because he's able to go out and make all these outrageous statements that, you know, have little to do with facts and exaggerate facts here and there. And, you know, he sounds good to lots of people. But when you
let me ask you a question on this statement that Trump in this video clip we just showed here, which I when I first heard it, I just went, hang on, what? You mentioned at the top of this that you said, you know, Trump started off, we're going to end the war. We're going to have a negotiated settlement. There was the Alaska and there was the last phone call, et cetera. And then he says, or he changed it to say, all right, now, all right, you know what? Y'all can go to the 1991 borders. That's what we'll do. And then here we go with this, with these sanctions here. But then in this clip, he says, you know, sometimes you just got to fight it out. So what is Russia, Ukraine, and China to make of that?
Well, if you can
answer that.
If you're in their shoes, I think you don't take anything that he says very seriously. And you also understand that even if you strike a deal with him or you think you struck a deal with him, he'll change his mind a day later or a week later. There's just no way you can trust Trump. And this is a huge liability for him. By the way, Danny, if you sort of look around the world at all the problems that we face and you look at Trump's attempts to deal with those problems, he's failed on almost every count. The idea that he shut down the Gaza genocide and, you know, brought peace to the Middle East is not a serious argument. He's failed in Ukraine. And we're going to talk about these negotiations with the Chinese. The Chinese beat him. He's not the winner here. The Chinese are the winners. Where's he been successful? I don't see any evidence.
Oh, he ended 8 wars. I don't know if you saw that, but yeah, he ended 8 wars.
Yeah.
Just ask him. He'll tell you.
Yeah, exactly.
But let me ask you, because I do want to pivot over to the China stuff here. I don't want to get away from too much time that we have on that. But with your IR theorist hat on, what does it do to the international relations theory, and I'm talking about adversaries and allies alike that are dealing with the United States, when you can't trust anything that the president of the U.S. says, whether it's threats or whether it's promises, how do people change how they deal with it? Because that's just not how business had been done in the United States for the last couple of centuries.
I think what it means is that you have to assume worst case all the time. And just to go to the Russia-Ukraine context, I think if you're the Russians, you have to understand that you can't make a deal where you actually make meaningful concessions to the Ukrainians and to the West, because you can't trust Trump not to welch on the deal. This is why I've argued that I believe the Russians will pursue a maximalist strategy regarding conquering territory and turning Ukraine into a dysfunctional rump state. If you give Ukraine maneuver room to rebuild after some sort of settlement and then to change its mind on NATO admission or NATO membership, you'll be in real trouble. So if you're the Russians, you want to do everything you can at this point in time to take as much territory as possible and to do everything you can to cripple Ukraine, because you can't trust the West. This is, you know, the essence of your question. You just can't trust anything that Trump says.
Well, and unfortunately, that tails right into the China stuff, because Trump, who loves to win and be seen as winning, especially domestically, had this really cheery example or evidence of how good this trip was in with China.
I thought it was an amazing meeting. He's a great leader of a very powerful, very strong country, China. And what can I say? We have, it was an outstanding group of decisions, I think, that was made. A lot of decisions were made. There wasn't too much left out there. Taiwan never came up. It was not discussed, actually. We had a long meeting, as you know, but a lot of things we discussed in great detail. A lot of things we brought to finalization. A lot of finalization. I thought it was a great meeting. I think it was a very friendly meeting. It was a good meeting for two very large, powerful countries. And that's the way we should get along with a large, powerful.
So you say that, unlike what Trump said, you said that the Chinese side came out on top. Why do you say that?
Well, let's go back to where this all started. It started last April. Was it Liberation Day when he launched all these tariffs on countries around the world? And he threatened to put massive tariffs on China. And he was going to bring the Chinese economy to its knees. He understands full well that we're in a security competition with China that has an economic dimension and a military dimension. And with regard to the economic dimension, he thought that we had the upper hand in terms of trade, and that tariffs were our war-winning weapon. But he was wrong. And the Chinese, who play hardball, had two aces up their sleeve. One was rare earths, to include rare earth magnets, and two was soybeans. And what the Chinese did was they basically started to cut off the flow of rare earths and rare earth magnets to the United States. And they stopped buying soybeans. This would have a crippling effect on the United States, especially the rare earths. We absolutely need those rare earths. And they monopolize the control of rare earths and rare earth magnets. So what Trump has done is he backed off. He backed off on tariffs. And the quid pro quo is that the Chinese have backed off for a year on the rare earths and rare earth magnets, and they're now going to buy soybeans. But the end result is, if you compare to where we are today with where we were in April, it's Trump who had to back down, not the Chinese. So his attempt to bring the Chinese economy to its knees with these tariffs failed.
I want to look at the tariff part second, but let's stick on the rare earth part, because I'm trying to understand what the significance is of the very limited time frame that China said, yeah, we'll put a 1 year freeze on all this stuff or go back to where it was for a year. And I know that Trump and the administration have made a number of deals with Malaysia and some other countries in Asia about rare earths, et cetera. There's a big funding issue going on in the United States to create the capacity to do so. But by the best sources that I can come up with, it would be somewhere around a decade before we would be able to be at the both the generation of the rares themselves, meaning mining them and having them reprocessed into a usable situation. So if you're talking about 1 year here and it would take us 10 years to get self-sufficient over here, what happens in that delta?
Well, what the Chinese are doing here is they're telling the United States, we'll give you a reprieve for 1 year, but then we'll renegotiate. And you want to keep that in mind, boys and girls, moving forward. And if you decide that you're going to play hardball with us in this 1 year that we now have, you want to understand that when we come to the table in 1 year, we might not be happy with you because of your past behavior.
That's a good point.
You just want to understand the Chinese are hardball players, and they're very smart. Right. Much smarter than the American leaders are, whether you're talking about Democrats or Republicans. Chinese are first class strategists. And of course, the same thing is true of Vladimir Putin. And the problem that the United States has is that it's led by second, if not third class strategists. And this included the Biden administration as well as the Trump administration. You just scratch your head when you watch what the Americans are doing, you know, both from a strategic point of view and a moral point of view, just to go to the Gaza genocide. I mean, think about that. Here's this great liberal democracy, the United States of America, that puts a remarkably high premium on human rights, defines the world in terms of good guys and bad guys, where we're the good guys and everybody who is against us is a bad guy. Well, this good guy, the United States of America, under first Joe Biden and now Donald Trump, is complicit in a genocide. This is really quite remarkable. And that's just the moral side of things. If you go to the strategic side of things, you look at what a hash we've made of things in the Middle East, not only with regard to Gaza, which we were talking about before, but Iran as well. You look at the situation regarding Ukraine, and how we've been dealing with China. It's depressing as an American to think about the low quality of our leadership. And, you know, people may say that guys like you and I are unpatriotic. We're not, you know, loyal to the United States. We're not America first. I would say, and I'm sure you would agree with me, on the contrary, right?
Yes.
We want America to be number one. We want America to behave as morally correct as possible, right? And we're critical of the United States because it's failing on both counts.
Right. That's exactly 100%. No dispute whatsoever. I want to look at the tariff issue itself and to kind of see where we are. So you mentioned Liberation Day when that first came out, and it ended up blowing up to 145% tariffs and et cetera. And then it got down to like 30 for a period of time. They were going through several rounds of negotiation. This one apparently is going to end at, according to Trump here, it's going to help on the fentanyl issue. I'd like you to talk about that, but also that the tariff rate, he said, would be down to at 47%.
Tariffs remain exactly the same.
55%.
It's about, it was 57, now it's 47.
And how long?
Because we reduced it by the fentanyl, and because I believe they are really taking strong action. We've already seen the action on fentanyl, and they're taking very strong action.
Yeah.
He's going to be very strong in enforcing the fentanyl, everything having to do with fentanyl and regulations internally, including taking very strong measures against those that don't obey.
So is this whole fentanyl issue and the drugs coming out of China, which with precursors and all that, is that just kind of for public consumption? And so China just said, sure, 10% off and we'll do something here as opposed to 20% off. So first of all, on the fentanyl issue, how serious is it? And is China really doing something to get drugs into the United States?
I honestly don't know, Danny. I mean, I've read a bit about this, but I can't make heads or tails of it. I don't know what to say. I mean, I think that, maybe they've taken certain steps that make Trump happy, and that allows him to reduce tariffs by 10%, or maybe they haven't done very much at all, but he's just looking for a rationale for reducing tariffs by 10% to keep Xi Jinping happy. Just very hard to say, for me to say. It's not an issue I can figure out very clearly.
And so about the total tariff. So it's right now he says that they're basically leaving China with a 47% tariff rate on Chinese good. What is that something that's sustainable? Is that something that's even good for America?
Well, there's this huge debate on whether these tariffs, work to America's advantage. And I think it remains to be seen whether they work out or not. I'm not an economist, and I just don't know what to make of it all. Some of the tariffs have been lowered. If you look at what's happened during the Asia trip with regard to both Japan and South Korea, right, it's quite clear that in both cases, the tariffs have been reduced to 15%. So that will be good for the American consumer, I think. Whether these 40%, 47% tariffs on China hurt the American consumer or damage the American economy, I think remains to be seen. But I'm not in a position to venture a guess on this. I can talk about strategic issues and foreign policy, but when it comes to tariffs in the economy, I don't know what to think.
Fair enough. Neither do I. We'll have to get somebody else on to cover that part. But the last thing I want to talk about before you do leave, because it's very much in line with something you mentioned a second ago about the morality and the utility of our foreign policy. And that's what's happening down around Venezuela at the moment, because by all accounts, it seems there's barely a fig leaf covered that we just want to get rid of Maduro. Then we want a regime change war and we'll get it. In fact, I think that the latest offer is Maduro either voluntarily walks away, he's assassinated, or he's captured. And we're saying that out loud and publicly. That doesn't seem to follow international law, as far as I'm aware. What do you say?
Oh, there's no question about that. But I would also note, just to talk about the morality of our foreign policy, we didn't talk about the fact that the United States is blowing boats out of the water and killing people,
right,
who we don't even know. We don't even know who they are or what they're doing. Supposedly, they're narco-terrorists who are bringing drugs to the United States or terrorists to the United States. But there's no evidence that that's true. And as we know, the U.S. Navy has the capability to stop these ships, board them, and find out exactly who is on board and what those people are doing. And you would think that the United States would do that before it just blew those ships out of the water, the ships, those boats, out of the water and killed all the people who were on the boats.
And so what does this do to our, I don't even say credibility, but to our interaction with other countries in the region, in our own hemisphere here, when you have the president of the United States, when asked about that issue that you just mentioned there, that there apparently is the legality and is the lawfare where you can on the high seas interdict and to find out what's on board these. And Trump just says, yeah, I don't want to mess with that. I don't want to worry about a declaration of war. We're just going to kill them. We're just going to kill those people. But is there any justification, internationally or otherwise, even domestically, to just summarily execute people because you suspect them of running drugs?
No, he's the assassin in chief, period. He thinks he has a right to kill anybody who he deems an enemy of the United States. He doesn't need any evidence to support that decision. He doesn't need to get approval from Congress. He is the assassin in chief, and he just does what he wants. And you have the same situation with regard to the Maduro government. He just has decided that we have to get rid of Maduro, and he's going to go in there and figure out some clever way to do that. And as you know, Danny, the United States has a rich history of behaving this way in the Western Hemisphere. We've had our gun sights on Cuba since probably about 1959, when Castro took over there. And you remember the Bay of Pigs in April 1961, shortly after JFK became president. And then there was the Cuban Missile Crisis, and we've been involved in Cuba trying to topple the government or the regime there forever and ever. And Venezuela is now in our gun sights as well. And of course, the Venezuelans and the Cubans have quite good relations for obvious reasons. But this is the way the United States has long acted in the Western Hemisphere. And I think virtually all of our neighbors south of the border fully understand that the United States is a ruthless country when it comes to running the Western Hemisphere, and they better be very careful that they don't anger the United States.
Do you ever see a scenario in the future where all of these things building up, all going back to the 50s, 60s, maybe even before that, that it can come back to haunt us, that maybe the conditions, we might not be in as much of a position of power, and that people would remember this and take action against us? Or is it a case that we're like, nope, they will always be powers and we can literally do what we want and there's nothing they can do about it?
Well, with regard to the Western Hemisphere, we are so powerful and so secure that we can behave in careless and ruthless ways. And by the way, during the unipolar moment, you know, from roughly 1992 up to about 2017, when we were the only great power on the planet and were remarkably powerful relative to everybody else and remarkably secure back here in the Western Hemisphere, we were able to behave in very cavalier and careless ways. And we got in the habit of acting that way, and it's carried over now into this multipolar world. But the United States, despite all the talk about how dangerous the world is and how vulnerable we are to this threat and that threat, the United States is the most secure great power in the history of the world. We're remarkably powerful, and if you look at our geographical location, it just doesn't get any better. You have Canada to the north, Mexico to the south, fish to the east and fish to the west. I mean, this is the ideal strategic situation. And it allows us to just do all these foolish things that would get other countries into deep trouble, but don't get us into much trouble. And someone like President Trump, he understands this. He understands how powerful we are. He understands what all the levers of power are, and he understands he can do pretty much everything and get away with it. And if you look at what's happening, I think that description is quite apt.
But one would imagine that the time does have a habit of changing things in the future, and there may come a day when we don't have that relative power dominance over everybody, and who knows how it may work out then. People may remember all of these things. I don't want to get into that situation. But listen, we really appreciate you coming on today, especially with all these things going on here. And just to shoot everybody back to your Substack there, where you don't have to wait for John to be on our show here. You can go to mearsheimer.substack.com to find all the great stuff, more commentary on this China stuff. You can go there and continue reading there. So thanks for coming on today.
Thank you, Danny. Although all these issues are categorically depressing, it is always enjoyable to talk to you.
Well, and certainly likewise, because if nothing else, it makes me think that we're not just crazy as it appears in comparison to what else is going on. So there is some sanity, and we appreciate you doing that as well. Thank you.
You're welcome.
And we appreciate you guys. And by the way, we got another show coming right up. Actually, Larry Johnson, who was just in Moscow and has some fresh perspective on how things may look there, especially in terms of this current offensive that's going on, these new nuclear-powered weapons that have coming off, and what may happen to negotiations later on. All that coming up with Larry Johnson here in about 5 minutes. So be sure and tune in, and we'll see you there in a few minutes. Bye.